Hello and welcome to Please Expand, and welcome to today's episode where I will be interviewing Dominic Sandbrook on his book Never Had It So Good. Never Had It So Good is the first installment in Dominic Sandbrook's now series on modern British history, which begins with Never Had It So Good, which takes its starting point from 1956, and the series so far, at least, culminates in his publication Who Dares Wins, which takes us into the beginning of the first Thatcher government. And I'm really excited to be interviewing Dominic Sandbrook on this book. This is a book that I have long adored, I think is the best way to put it. It's a fascinating book that really illuminates a period of British history that I think few of us know about, or at the very least, I didn't know much about. And I hope you will find it as illuminating as I have, and I hope it will inspire you to pick up the book and read it for yourself. So in today's interview, we'll be talking about a lot of issues. But some of the highlights will be the beginning of a new kind of identity for Great Britain following 1956 and the Suez Crisis, and how its relationship with America and the EU develops, not too dissimilar situation to what we're dealing with nowadays in early 2025. We'll be looking at what I consider to be a triangular relationship of topics: immigration, decline of empire, and Britain realizing a new role for itself in the world. And we'll also be unraveling the intricacies of conservative economic policy in the late 50s, early 60s. I hope that you will enjoy this episode. Dominic Sandbrook is really exceptional. He gives very thoughtful responses to my questions, and it was a real pleasure interviewing him. So without further ado, let's get to the interview. Hello and welcome. And Dominic Sandbrook, thank you very much for coming on the podcast to talk about your book, Never Had It So Good.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a great honor.
Thank you very much. So I just wanted to start off by saying how much I enjoyed your book, because it's about a period of modern British history that was a complete blank to me. Right. We don't study it at all in school. Mm-hmm. And you hear about these figures, about Attlee, Eden, Suez. And they obviously are such important figures in, you know, how we got to where we are now. But it's a period that we don't seem to talk about that much, at least in our formative years. So reading your book was really eye-opening.
That's really kind of you.
Yeah. So your book spans 1956 to 1963. Yeah. And so you start with 1956 because of the Suez Crisis, right? And you sort of an important moment in the decline of the British Empire, of British international prestige. And you sort of, you bookend your book with end of 1963, which sees the end of 13 years of sort of uncontested Conservative Party in Britain. So I guess the first thing I wanted to ask you is, why did you start at those dates? What was it about the Suez Crisis? Because, you know, you make the point in one of your chapters that the decline of the British Empire, you know, one could think it started a bit earlier, maybe with India and Pakistan in 47, or one of the other nations that left before 56. So what was it in your mind about 1956 that was the right place to start?
It's a great question. It's a really good question. And thank you for reading the book so closely and so thoughtfully. So the real story, so often when you write books, is kind of very complicated and messy. Initially, what I wanted to do actually was to write about the 1960s, about Britain in the 1960s. So I'd formed this sort of ambition at the turn of the 2000s, at the sort of turn of the 21st century. There were books on the 60s already, but they were generally written by sort of 60s veterans, people who had lived through it. And I was sort of fascinated by it because, you know, I'm a 1974 baby. 60s was really the day, you know, the era before the first era I could remember. And I wanted to write something. I was working on American history at the time, and I wanted to write. There were lots of books on America in the 60s and 70s and 50s and stuff. And I wanted to write something that had some of the same spirit as some of those histories. So, you know, a sense of kind of capturing the cultural excitement at the time, what it was like to you know, what daily life was like, but also the big kind of political and economic kind of shifts. And because I wanted to do the 60s, I thought, you know, well, you know, you're not going to start on the 1st of January 1960. And so 1956 actually seemed a good kickoff point for that. Because, I mean, it's around the mid-50s that, well, there are multiple things happening. So just in a very trivial way, you have the advent of Bill Haley and his Comets, of rock and roll music. People, newspapers and things start, people start talking about youth culture, about teenagers, about rock and roll and jukeboxes and that kind of world in a way that they hadn't quite done before. Underlying all that was a big economic boom. So the end of austerity and the last rations are lifted, I think, in 1955. Sorry, I'm a bit hazy on the details because it's sometimes as I wrote this. And there's a real sense, I think, in the mid-50s that a sense of economic renewal, and that in the forefront are the new generation, people who didn't live necessarily or were very small during the Second World War, who are now, they've got more money in their pockets, there's full employment, all of those kinds of things. And then the third element of that choice of opening date is, of course, as you said, the Suez Crisis. So I think the thing about Suez, so for those people who are listening to this who are not incredibly familiar with the details, there's no reason why you should be. Britain and France got it into their heads that Colonel Nasser, the nationalist leader of Egypt, was a tremendous threat and was the kind of new Mussolini and whatnot. And they cooked up a scheme with the Israelis, which would basically involve Israel and Egypt going to war, and then Britain and France pretending to intervene to separate the warring parties, but actually Britain using this opportunity to recapture the Suez Canal, which was historically seen as this incredibly important artery linking the Mediterranean with the Red Sea, and therefore this kind of conduit of empire. And the thing about Suez, which was a terrible humiliation for Britain because the Americans basically put a stop to it, was it wasn't that it changed anything. So as you absolutely rightly say, the British Empire didn't start declining in 1956. I mean, actually, thinking about it, I would probably put the decline, you could argue the decline had begun 30 years before, not even 10 years before, but 30 years before. But what somebody wrote, there was a Whitehall memo published after the crisis had kind of, you know, the dust had settled. And it said what Suez did was it didn't change the realities, but it revealed them. Mm. And what Suez sort of brought home to people, people who deluded themselves, I think, to some degree, including people in British politics and not just ordinary punters, it revealed the extent to which Britain had regressed from the top rank of the world's powers to, you know, the echelon below. So in other words, that Britain could not act in really independently of the United States in the world anymore. And I thought the combination of those three things, so the youth culture thing, the economic picture, and the sort of geopolitical, it made a perfect entry point. But what I think is also really important about Suez and the decline of the empire is what you have in the late 50s is a rejection of the old kind of image of Britain and its self-image as well. So the image abroad and its self-image. So the book begins with Britain attempting to recapture the kind of gunboat diplomacy of the 19th century. That's how it begins. And it actually ends with a very different kind of diplomacy in a way, which is the Beatles preparing to go to the United States for the first time at the beginning of 1964. Now, had Britain, one of my sort of more madcap ideas is that had Britain still been powerful, had it still been Lord Palmerston's country, merrily kind of pushing other people around, the success of the Beatles, there might have been more resistance to it. They would be seen as cultural representatives of a kind of hegemonic power, rather than Britain was almost able to reinvent itself as a bit of a joke in the 60s. So you get the use of the Union Jack in kind of iconography and stuff. People wearing Union Jack underpants and things. If that flag had been flying on battleships off your coast, you might have been less inclined to buy the records of people who brandished it as a kind of ironic symbol. So I thought there was a, I've come to think there might be a sort of slightly tenuous connection there. And so I do think 1956, it does feel like in the mid-50s in Britain, there is a kind of shift in the mood, a shift in the economic picture and the political picture. And that all, the 60s start there, really. And that's why I chose the data that I did. And closing in 1963, so the Tory administration, which has been in power since the very beginning of the 1950s, is very clearly on its last legs at the end of 1963. That Harold Macmillan has, who is this kind of great living link with history, who had fought in the First World War, who had been kind of a Churchill side, as Eden had as well. He's gone, and there's just a sort of sense that there's a new beginning waiting to happen. And so that's why I ended the book where I did.
Yeah, no, it's not entirely a mad idea, I suppose, because I'm not really sure what images of Britain were like before this period, but since this period, I get the impression that it's very much an image of quaintness, of sort of awkwardness. I'm thinking of Fawlty Towers here. It's a bit later than this period, but just, I mean, similarly to the way that people feel about American cultural exports, you can see people thinking similarly about British cultural exports if things were going differently in the international
Yeah,
situation.
I think absolutely. So I wrote another book called The Great British Dream Factory, which was largely about this, which was about how Britain kind of reinvented itself in the mid 20th century as a kind of cultural power. And you see this, the apotheosis of that was the opening ceremony for the 2012 Olympics, which was all about stories and it was about music and all these things. But up till the 1960s, Britain had never sold itself as a musical country. It had never, people didn't perceive it as that abroad. They didn't think of that at home, but both abroad and at home, they thought we're a country of like hard-nosed industrialists. All that people would say the British, all they care about is making money, building factories and making money. And then once that falls into sort of decrepitude, that image of Britain, then Britain is free to reinvent itself as this kind of zany entertainer to the world. But you couldn't have, Britain wouldn't have done that if it hadn't already lost that previous kind of preeminence. So I think the two are much more closely linked than people realize.
Yeah, that's great. Okay, so since you've already started talking so much about Suez and this change of Britain's position in the world, I wondered if we could talk about what I took to be like a triad of themes in your book. So you got the decline of empire, you've got Britain's realignment from the Commonwealth to the EU, and then the US. Some are trying to align with the EU, some not. And finally, you've got this mass migration movement, which is changing how, I guess, the empire or the consequences of empire relate to or impact British society at home. One of the what something that you say a lot, and I feel like this is one of your this is almost one of your
One
theme
of my
tunes,
ticks, one of my ticks.
is that these things didn't matter that much to people as we tend to think.
Yeah, I said that with everything then.
Well, apart from disposable income, that seems to be all that matters.
It's all I care about.
So maybe we could just talk about that. How did people's perception of themselves as Brits change over this period? Was there a on I'm talking about I guess we could talk about Whitehall as well as the individuals, but how did this realignment from Commonwealth to US slash EU, how did this increase in immigration, how did the decline in world status, how did these three, which I take to be very interlinked
Yes.
themes, play out in the way people saw themselves?
Okay, it's a fantastic question. Yeah, you're absolutely right. They are interlinked. But I think people feel differently about different parts of that kind of triad, as you put it. So first of all, on the world status issue, the complexity, I think, is that my sense is that most people enjoyed being what they thought of as, to borrow the phraseology of 1066 and all that, they enjoyed being top nation. They went to school, often in buildings where it had a map of the world, splashed with sort of reddish pink. Those bits were British or British Empire or protectorates or mandates or whatever they might be. And yeah, generations certainly a couple of generations of children had grown up with that, and they felt good about themselves. Who doesn't want to be number one? You know, obviously that's ingrained in people's sense of themselves as British. And to some degree, if you're talking about, let's say, in the 1950s, for 200 years, let's say, people had had a sense of Britain as a kind of Protestant nation, of liberty, of maritime power, free trade, all of these things, and Britain ruling the waves, you know, that kind of stuff. And that's absolutely there in people's imagination. So, for example, when they're in the fight in the Second World War or something, and it's going very badly at the beginning, I think people still sort of think, well, we've got the fleet, we've got the empire, we'll never surrender, you know, all that kind of stuff that Churchill taps into so brilliantly in his speeches. So that's there. What makes that complicated, though, is historians have very different views about this, so this is just my own opinion. I don't think most people ever really cared about the empire per se. They liked being top, but as if you said to them, how much does it matter to you that we have Tanganyika or Malaya or Cyprus? I mean, a lot of people didn't know where these places were. They'd never been to them. They didn't care about them. If they were told them they'd be better off without them, they'd be delighted. You know, they weren't that bothered. And that, I think, you know, people have often, now historians have had big arguments about this. Some say the experience of empire was woven into so much of British life. I mean, obviously there are lots of ways in which it was, you know, you went into the shop and there were products from Jamaica or whatever, sugar and tea and all these kinds of things from different parts of the empire. But at the same time, there's also a kind of indifference, I think, you know, to ordinary people who are working in factories, going down mines, you know, working in a shop in a small town. What do they care? They've never been to Canada, you know. So there's a sort of people's feelings about it are complicated. And I think because of that, when a given, you know, an African colony or something becomes independent in this period that I cover in the book, the late 50s, early 60s, among the public at large, the reaction is total and utter indifference. Now, among retired colonels and former colonial administrators, and people who care about these kinds of things, which is a tiny minority, there is a reaction often. People are very perturbed about it. And of course, there are also some people who are delighted because they've always been anti-imperialist, because there's always been that strain in Britain too. But the great majority of people are much more bothered about the price of eggs than they are about any given imperial development. And now, so on that, I think what actually happened is that, you know, people would see on the kind of news, on the newsreels or something, they'd see the flag goes down in Ghana or whatever, the Union Jack, and is replaced by the flag of the newly independent colony. And maybe not everyone listening to this will agree, but I think an awful lot of people just couldn't actually care less. What they do care about, though, which is different and why the Suez Crisis is important, is they care about a diminution of status and Britain's sort of ranking in the eyes of the world. It's why later on in the 1970s, when there was a sense that Britain was being humiliated by the Ugandan dictator Idi Amin, that really seemed to kind of cut through with the public, because that was not so much about the specifics of each case, you know, whether Idi Amin has got hostages, or whether he's kicking people out of Uganda, or whether he's just kind of giving interviews in which he's being rude about Britain, but it's kind of the optics of it. Of a former British colonial subject kind of mocking the former colonial power. And I think that did matter, and that would come up in interviews. People would say, we're being pushed around in the world. Or they'd say, you know, Arab oil sheikhs are buying up London hotels. It's not right. We're Britain. This shouldn't happen. So I think that that's sort of amorphous sense. You know, people are often not really, most people don't follow the headlines. I mean, they certainly don't follow the stories that are below the headlines. But it's the sort of general narrative and sense that I think certainly in the mid-60s started to, people really started to notice. Maybe not so much in the early 50s, in the early to mid-1950s.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that side of things. Now, the next bit is the Commonwealth versus Europe.
Could I just ask a question?
Yeah.
Just on that sense of humiliation,
yeah,
that people felt when they were pushed around, I can see this idea of the former colony sort of trying to, you know, throw its weight around and people feeling a bit like that shouldn't really be happening. Yeah. But in your book, I also get the impression that people feel that way about America as well.
Yeah, they do. Totally, they do. Yeah, they do. They feel that Americans are kind of beneath them, vulgar, annoying, loud, all that stuff. And with Suez, for example, there's a lot of people who think the Americans really let us down. They're meant to be on our side. You know, they're meant to just do what we tell them. They're very rich and big, but we should be able, basically, you know, they think of that they're the senior partner, but we are really the senior partner because we're old and clever. And actually, the sense of outrage in Britain in the late 50s, it's also exacerbated by a sense that clearly in the late 1950s, the United States is by far the world's cultural hegemon through its youth culture, but through kind of high, you know, abstract expressionism, wonderful films, novels, whatever. And that suddenly Britain is very dowdy and shabby by comparison. So there's a bit, there's a sort of bit of resentment there. There's a worry that British culture is being Americanized, that everybody's watching American films, they're watching American TV programs, they're wearing American clothes. And that creates a sort of insecurity, I think. And that goes hand in hand with this sort of strategic insecurity. So you're absolutely right. That is there. It's not just about the former colonists. I mean, of course, the United States is a former colony, though most people probably wouldn't have thought about it as, you know, they didn't, their historical imagination didn't stretch back as far as the 18th century.
Probably not, no.
And then now the Commonwealth Europe thing is really interesting. I think that's one thing that I probably would do differently if I wrote the book now. So I wrote the book in the early 2000s, and it didn't really occur to me then. I mean, obviously there were always people who were Eurosceptics, but it didn't occur to me when I was writing the book that one day people would be reading it in a world in which Britain would have left the EU. And actually, if I wrote that stuff again, I would have thought about that, you know, differently. I mean, what is true is that Britain was always very suspicious of the European project by and large. Lots of people were suspicious on both sides, and, you know, every side, actually, of the political spectrum. There were always lots of people who felt that the Commonwealth was where, you know, our hearts lay. Even as the, you know, the countries of the Commonwealth, you know, Australia, Canada, New Zealand, and so on, were showing less and less interest in Britain and actually were carving out their own separate futures, I think a lot of people in Britain were still attached to this slightly sentimental idea, this very romantic idea of a kind of Anglosphere and a kind of Commonwealth community. And what you have between 1956 and 63 is actually politicians and civil servants in Whitehall kind of wrestling with the reality that once the big, you know, industrial and sort of trading powers of Western Europe have decided to combine, Britain has to, you know, what does Britain do then? Is Britain going to be shut out? Does the Commonwealth really represent an alternative pole? Can we cobble together something with some other European countries, which is what we did with EFTA, the European Free Trade Association? Or do we bite the bullet and say, oh God, reality has sunk in. We actually have to join this common market, whether we like it or not. The funny thing that was relatively absent, I would say, and is that, of course, there are some people who are, you know, who are swept up with the joy of European brotherhood and unity. I mean, Edward Heath is the most famous example of that, but they're a tiny minority, really, I would say. There are always a high opinion formers who are very excited about European brotherhood, But actually, among the general public, their sense is always one of grumbling and skepticism. And I think deep down, if you had said to people in 1961, would you like to be in a very close-knit union with Australia, Canada, and New Zealand, which was never going to happen, or would you like to be in with Luxembourg, Belgium, Italy, West Germany, and France? You know, very smart and indeed idealistic people would have said, oh, they'd much prefer the Commonwealth. I mean, Clement Attlee is the great example of that. Now, he's asked about the common market, and he says, he has this very sort of pithy, very, very Clement Attlee reply where he says, oh, the so-called common market of six nations. He says, very recently, this country spent an awful lot of blood and money rescuing four of the members of that group from the other two. And what he means by that is, you know, let's not get involved with these clans again. And there'll be a lot of people who would have shared that, actually. And that's so Britain, when it finally decides to enter, which it does, it makes Harold Macmillan is moving towards that at the end of the period I describe in the book, sort of 62, 63. It's so grudging and half-hearted. You know, they're doing it because they feel they have to. They're not doing it because they want to. And that, I think that issue, and I would definitely have brought this out if I'd write the book again, the extent to which that hung over British life and the British imagination, you know, for the next few decades. I mean, it was always there at the center, at the heart of Britain's kind of relationship with Europe, a slight sense of that it was a grudging, unhappy marriage, certainly on the British side.
I feel as if there was humiliation in that too when their attempt to join was vetoed by de Gaulle, right? France. Yeah.
Well, twice. I mean, not just in this book, but in the next book, he vetoes it again. Right. So, yes, absolutely. Which is a funny thing that hasn't massively been talked about since the Brexit referendum. Mm. But Britain did try to join twice, and de Gaulle said no. And de Gaulle's argument was, and he wasn't necessarily wrong, de Gaulle said the British don't feel European. They're just going to come in and make it a misery for everybody by whinging about things. They've got all these trading relationships with their Commonwealth, with their, you know, Australia and stuff. They're much too pro-American. They're much too interested in what's going on in the United States. They will just be a pain to have at the meetings, and they'll ruin our dream of a united continental European common market. And you could sort of say, well, you know, de Gaulle vetoing it twice means that Britain always gets off on the wrong foot and it spoils it from the very beginning. Mm-hmm. But you could also say, well, de Gaulle wasn't wrong. I mean, mm-hmm. Britain did cut a sort of grumpy and grudging figure for the next few decades.
Yeah, and it's funny because if I remember correctly, the image, the idea that Britain had was that they would sort of be the US representative in the EU.
Yeah, they'd be the bridge. Well, that was the bridge that was all, people always used to say, Britain is the bridge between Europe and America. And people in Britain and Europe would often kind of frown at that and bridle a bit. And sort of they'd be like, but you are actually European. You're deluding yourselves to think that you're the bridge. And the British would say, oh, no, we are. You know, that's our role. That's how we see ourselves. We don't see ourselves as European in quite the same way that you see yourselves. We have a different history and different traditions. And as much as people might like to say, well, they should have ditched that idea. It's hard to persuade people to ditch their idea of themselves. You know, you can't persuade people to be something that they don't think they are, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, you really get the feeling that this is a real torturous time for, maybe more so for politicians than for ordinary people, but for British politicians, because they're holding all these contradictory thoughts in mind. They want to be top nation, and on the other hand, they want to be best buds with America, which really implicitly means you are America's lapdog.
Yeah.
They want to join the EU, but they want to be better than the EU by being the bridge with America. And the reason why they're in this quagmire is because of the decline of the empire, which they're also trying to kind of save face by appearing to be too concerned about it, but also scrambling to realign themselves in the new world.
Yeah, but it's a good example. Here's the thing. I think it's a really good example of how people are not kind of unfettered free agents in history. People are constrained by their own histories, by their own predilections, by the expectations of their voters, and by all kinds of structural things. So in other words, you could sort of say, well, you know, and people have often done this, especially after Brexit, people have said, oh, well, they should have done something different. They should have joined straight away. They should have got rid of, they hung on to the empire for too long. They should have got rid of the empire you know, immediately after the Second World War or whatever, whatever. But there is no even remotely plausible scenario, alternative scenario, in which they do those things, because that would have been, they'd have had to be in other people.
Yeah.
You know, even people in, you know, Clement Attlee's Labour government, Clement Attlee believes Britain is a world power and should still be a world power. His foreign secretary, Ernest Bevin, instrumental in setting up NATO, is a sort of staunch bulldog-like working class patriot. And to imagine people like that saying, you know what, we should have a European common market and we should be really enthusiastic members of it and we should get rid of all the colonies now, they'd have had to kind of rewrite their entire lives to have those views at all. So people are, the British are where they are, in, as you say, in a kind of a bit of a mess, in a massive dilemma, but they could not have been otherwise. So when Harold Macmillan writes his famous paper in whatever it is, I can't remember, the early 1960s, where he says, God almighty, you know, we're stuck between the United States, which probably doesn't care about us as much as we hope it does. And then he says, we're in danger of being stuck between them and a, what's he called it? He said, a boastful Europe of Charlemagne, meaning France and Germany, France and German dominated. He's kind of right, but that's a really hard thing for any British government to resolve, because they can't really turn their backs on the history, the imaginative legacy of the past, all of those kinds of things. And it's obviously a dilemma that successive British governments wrestle with. But in a weird way, I think it's one that, I think one of the great fallacies about Britain's history with Europe is that that question will ever be closed. I think people will still be arguing about it long after, you know, after I'm dead. Because actually that's a question that runs all the way through British history. You know, who are we? What's our place in the world? Are we, is our future kind of a maritime one or a continental one? And so they're the prisoners of that history too.
Right. Could you say a bit about immigration as well, and the impact that that had on?
Well, yeah. So immigration is a slightly different one, because, of course, that's, you could argue to some degree that's the empire coming home. Mm-hmm. It's not just the empire coming home though, because of course all Western European countries have a degree of immigration. Including from places where they didn't have colonies. So, for example, you look at Belgium. Belgium has a, ends up with a large Moroccan population, but Belgium didn't have a colony in Morocco. It's because, obviously, French-speaking, because so lots of Moroccans go to France, and they go just one step further, which is to Belgium. You know, you have lots of Turks and Germany. So it's not just about empire. It's also about the demand for labor in the 1950s, the reviving economies of Europe. It's about the ease of transport and travel, all those things. But obviously the empire for Britain is a large part of it. Now, we were joking earlier about me saying ordinary people don't care about some things, and they don't. They did care about immigration. Of that, there is no doubt at all. And the reality is it was very unpopular. It came up again and again, sort of, as politicians say, it came up on the doorstep again and again. Of course, not everybody disliked it. You know, there were people who arguing from the start for tolerance and for make more of an effort to welcome people and to, you know, be good hosts or whatever the people would have put it at the time. It's obviously a very variegated and complicated picture, because also the different groups are very different.
Yeah.
Some are unskilled laborers with little education, who have come basically to work in mills and factories and things. Some are your stereotypical kind of professional doctors or you know, teachers or whatever. So it's complicated, but by and large, polls suggest that it was really, really unpopular. In the 1960s, so after the peak really comes at the end of the 1950s, because the government's about to introduce legislation at the beginning of the 1960s to try and limit immigration from the Commonwealth. So then there's a big rush before the deadline in kind of 1960, 1961, 1962. But even a few years later, when people are being asked at the end of the 1960s, you know, what are the big changes of the post-war years that you most dislike? Immigration is number one. You know, people are very grumpy about it, hostile about it. You know, the truth of the matter is, of course, no government ever really made a concerted effort to kind of sell immigration to the public. because they thought it was an impossible seller, I suspect, as part of it. A sense of imperial superiority plays a part. So there's a long, you know, I remember myself in the, born in the 70s, the kind of children's books that you read, that sense of kind of racial superiority was absolutely built in. But also immigration, sometimes some people just don't like the newcomers. They don't like new people. They don't like their habits. They don't like them, and they don't want them there. But also for some people, immigration becomes mixed up with other issues. So the transformation of your local neighborhood, maybe because some of the old slums have been knocked down, some of the old terrace streets have been knocked down, and they've put up, the council has paid for new high-rise tower blocks, which you maybe don't like. And quite a lot of the tenants in those tower blocks may be newcomers from India, Pakistan, from South Asia, from the Caribbean. And so you kind of end up equating the two. So this is what people would do. People would say, you know, in the interviews, they would say, oh, it's terrible. You know, they only care about the immigrants. They've put up these big towers and they've stuffed them full of immigrants. It's a disgrace. Yeah, people would come out with that kind of thing.
Right.
So I think immigration is both a massive issue in itself, but it also, for some people, serves as kind of a shorthand for social and cultural changes that they are anxious about. Because as the affluent society kicks in, economic change, there are winners as well as losers. And you know, somebody, if you, I always think about this in kind of generational terms, that if you were kind of a working class family in a town in Britain, the new opportunities and the new affluence of the 1950s and 60s may mean that your son, let's say, or indeed your daughter, goes off to university, first in the family to go to university, gets a good job, ends up marrying, but lives away from home, so you've lost touch with them. You're stuck in a neighborhood that's maybe in decline. New people are coming in as the young people are going out. New people are coming in. You don't like the new, you know, sometimes you might not like the new people. You feel anxious about it. You know, your industry is under threat because Britain's losing market share. People are being laid off. And all these things get jumbled up in people's minds into this sort of combination of resentments. And I think that is simmering all the way through the late 1950s, 1960s, and then really comes to fruition in the kind of 70s and 80s.
It's interesting because you do emphasize, you do talk a lot about people's attitudes to immigration.
Yeah. But
maybe I'm misremembering, can't remember well, but I get the impression that it wasn't a real election issue.
No, absolutely right. Yeah.
And that's interesting. I mean, at least in your account, Macmillan cares much more about the economy than about anything else.
Well, so
what's going on there?
People don't care about anything more than they care about money. It's the reality. I mean, that's what I would. That sounds a very simplistic thing to say, but general elections throughout this period, I think it is a fascinating. I think it's a great question. I think it's remarkable that immigration isn't a bigger issue. It is in 1964 in one place in particular, in a place called Smethwick in the West Midlands, which becomes a kind of litmus test. There's a guy called Peter Griffith, who was a Conservative candidate who campaigned very heavily on immigration and won. But he was regarded by most people in the political class, in the kind of political world, as a pariah. People, Harold Wilson called him a parliamentary leper because he had campaigned so aggressively on immigration that when Enoch Powell speaks out about immigration in 1968, he too becomes a kind of pariah. But by and large, yeah, it is really, really remarkable that in 1959, in 1964, the decline of the empire, the dramatic change in Britain's world status, the influx of so many newcomers, that these things are not election issues, really. The elections, and part of that, I think, is that people, it's a period of great economic change as well. And so people are voting with their pocketbooks, to use the American expression. They are voting on jobs, on prices in the shops, on housing, these kinds of things. Those bread and butter issues. I mean, my argument, I guess, would be that those always matter more in elections, that often it actually, when people go into the voting booth, even now, they think, who will make me better off, or who will protect the gains that I've made? And that's what motivates people. It's one thing that I think actually some of the people who are the historians who are very keen to emphasize the importance of empire, I think slightly get wrong, is they themselves are really interested in the empire and in race and all these kinds of things. And they project that onto the people they're writing about in the past. But I think a lot of people in the past are much less interested in that. I think it's an absolutely remarkable, extraordinary thing, really, when you think that Britain had had the world's largest empire, that in this period covered in this book, there are two elections in 1959 and 1963 at the peak of the point when the empire is disappearing. And it barely features really in the national conversation about those elections because people don't care.
Yeah. What makes it all the more interesting is that we're talking, it seems that nowadays it's even more present. It's almost as if the empire just finished yesterday.
Yeah.
And people are talking about it much, almost as if there's this delayed aftershock of
definitely. The empire. Definitely. I think definitely, I think you're absolutely right. There's a bit of a delayed aftershock, but also in the public, the public mind, the public kind of conversation only has room for a certain number of things.
Mm.
And the impact of the new affluent society, people buying all these new appliances and all these new things and the cultural transformation that comes along with it, that's what's on people's mind a lot. And then when they think about foreign affairs and Britain's place in the world, we're so close to the Second World War. And I think the Second World War hangs over that period. And of course, the Cold War as well. And then the empire on top of that and the immigration, you know, they've only got room in their heads for so much. And I think that's part of the reason.
Yeah. Okay, great. All right. So let's move on to another interesting theme. Again, related to what we're sort of jumping off from what we've been talking about. You spend a lot of time in your books talking about the arts. So you spend a lot of ink on books, plays, films. My first question is, did you actually read and watch all of these?
I'd say so. Yeah, I think so.
Incredible.
I mean, maybe I can't remember. I can't necessarily, if I've really talked about something in detail, then yeah, definitely.
Amazing.
If I'm just mentioning it in a kind of list, then yeah. maybe not everything, but I mean, a lot. What do I talk about in Never Heard So Good? The novels of Kingsley Amis or the kind of kitchen sink kind of new plays. Yeah.
John Osborne.
John Osborne, the new wave kind of films of the early 60s. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I hope if you're going to give me the test, I'm sure I'll probably...
No. I'd like to start through them. Actually.
I mean, partly because the book, when I wrote the book, it was because I really loved the kind of culture of the time. I mean, to be fair, there's no better way of actually losing your love of the culture of something than by writing a book about it. So a lot of these things I haven't looked at since. But no, absolutely. I really loved, I like the poems of Larkin. I like Kingsley Amis's books, even though they're very unfashionable now. I think those sort of gritty early 60s films are brilliant. So yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And that's one of the great things being a historian. You get to sort of, to time travel. You get to go back to another, something like this. You can immerse yourself in the culture of the era.
Yeah,
and I think it's actually, although it's very, very unfashionable now, the kind of culture of the 50s and 60s in Britain, I think it's great. I love it.
Great then. Okay, so I want to talk in particular about this group called The Movement, which includes, as you mentioned, Kingsley Amis and Philip Barr. Well, they're sort of bunched into it. They themselves don't.
Yeah.
It's not as if they got together and declared themselves as
The
Movement. And the reason why I found Amis and Larkin in particular really interesting is because they are so acerbic. They're so critical of this affluent society, which is, you would think, is actually meant to benefit precisely these kinds of people. They're sort of from working class, aspirational, you know, upper working, lower middle class families. Yeah. They go, is it Oxford they go to?
Yeah, Oxford, St. John's, Oxford. Yeah.
They go to Oxford. They're doing quite well in life. And then after Oxford, they sort of continue this epistolary friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not, it's not the image of the artist that you would normally think of, this anti-affluent, anti-foreign, patriotic. They hate anything European and American. They just want to drink their tea. They don't want to go abroad. They're not interested in traveling. So I guess I think that they present interesting individual human case studies for this portion of society that may be getting richer, may be benefiting from certain economic policies, but which is nevertheless antagonistic towards it, maybe ambivalent about this new cultural milieu that they're finding themselves in.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think there's a sensibility, I think, is what it is. And it's not just Amos and Larkin, they're very exaggerated versions of it, but it's a sensibility that's kind of widely shared. It's very masculine. Mm-hmm. So actually, again, looking at the book now, I'd probably think about it differently. Maybe we'll be more aware of that than I was when I was writing it 20 years ago. It's kind of quite aggressive. It's, as you say, very acerbic, kind of almost abrasive sometimes. Very contemptuous. I mean, Kingsley Amis and Larkin famously of anything foreign, of anything idealistic. Now, what I think a lot of this is a reaction against the 1930s. So it's a reaction against the culture that they, you know, it's the people, they're kicking against their elders. And, you know, Amis and Larkin got reviews when they started, certainly Amis in the 1950s. I think it's Somerset Maugham who said they were scum. You know, that they are kind of vulgar, that they're not, because there's that sort of culture of the 1930s, 1920s, 1930s, which seems more flamboyant, more affected, more obviously politically more idealistic, more bohemian. They're very anti-bohemian. So in that sense, they're slightly in the tradition of George Orwell, which is kind of, we represent the people, the British people. We're all about drinking pints and going to the pub. And if we see a man with a beret, you know, let's do him to death. You know, that kind of thing. And it's a sort of, they were in their tweed jackets and, you know, sort of trudging around in sensible shoes. Rain is pouring down and they're on the way for another pint. That's the kind of world that they celebrate, and that they're determined to do that. It's part of a kind of inward turn, I think, in British culture in the 1950s after the Second World War. It's part, maybe part of that kind of rejection of the idea of empire and great power status and that kind of stuff, that as those things are declining, so the British are kind of hunching their shoulders, drawing their overcoats around them, excessively heavy kind of tweed overcoats, turning inwards. And there's a sort of, you know, people often say now when they're sort of being mean about the culture of that period, they will say, you know, there is a kind of maybe a narrowness, a willful narrowness to it. I should say, I love all that stuff. So I'm not sort of trying to beat up on them by saying that, but I think there is a kind of a willed kind of parochialism to it.
Yeah.
Which, again, I think is part of that reaction against their elders, who'd been much more obviously kind of cosmopolitan.
Do you think they really, do you see them as being representative of a portion of society?
Yeah, I think so. I think particularly the kind of grammar school boys. So there's a real cult of the grammar school boy in the 50s and 60s, the kind of self-made, as you said, kind of upper working class, lower working class, aspirational family, often the first in the family to go to university, hardworking, but doesn't like the posh people at the top, doesn't like the kind of the posh people who have, you know, who spend their summers in Italy and have friends in France and all that kind of thing. They're resentful of that. They're anxious about it. So they sort of... They turn up their noses against it and scoff at it and say, well, you must be, you know, let's laugh at them. Let's make fun of them. There's a sort of hatred of effeminacy in that sort of culture of the 50s and 60s. It's kind of all about being a gritty man's man and all that sort of thing. And I think there are people, like a lot of people for whom they speak, actually. I mean, so when Kingsley Amis writes Lucky Jim, one reason I spent a lot of time on Lucky Jim, or indeed John Osborne to some extent with Look Back in Anger, is that they're seen as spokesmen for a generation. People can see there's a lot of people who think like that, maybe just out of the universities, first generation university students, particularly men, and that they're not just going to sort of sit at the feet of the intellectuals of the 30s. They actually despise them. They kick against them. They reject them. So I do think it's simple. And it's seen at the time. The reason that the movement kind of, which is now completely forgotten, actually, but the movement mattered in the time where it featured in the newspapers, or newspaper phenomenon, was because people thought this is a symptom of a deeper change.
Okay, great. That's just one aspect. I mean, there are so many things that you touch on. Colin Wilson,
yeah,
was the most hilarious.
Who remembers him now, Colin Wilson? But like, Colin Wilson was a big celebrity for about a year. He was a big name. Yeah. In the papers with his book The Outsider, this great British existentialist, slept on a sleeping bag in Hampstead Heath,
yeah,
or whatever. And then his star just completely, you know, his bubble kind of bursts. People said, oh no, he's actually a terrible man and writing dreadful books. And I think he was writing dreadful books.
Well, that's very encouraging. Okay, so I kind of want to wrap things up then with just a discussion about conservative economic policy.
Wow, okay. Right, we're getting into the heavy stuff now.
Because, well, clearly it interested you a lot because you spent a lot of time going through all these different strands in the Conservative Party.
Yeah.
And clearly it's important because it seems to be responsible for, you know, the uninterrupted 13 years of conservative power.
Yeah.
There's that lovely Private Eye cartoon with Harold Macmillan, I think in 1959, surrounded by kitchen appliances.
Yeah.
He's sort of pleased with himself and looking around and saying, well, we all fought a good election.
Yeah. Right? Yeah, exactly.
And so clearly it's really important for the creation of this, of the affluent society. And in particular, though, I want to talk about the sort of the schism that appears between, so they're all concerned about inflation. Inflation is the boogeyman, much like nowadays, is the boogeyman of this period. And you've got people like Macmillan, who's all about keeping employment high and spending a lot of money and sort of almost not trying to deal with inflation.
Yeah.
And you've got people like Peter Thornycroft, Enoch Powell.
Yeah.
We're all about cutting inflation. I think the word you use, inflation, was a crusade for them.
Yeah, exactly.
And they don't care if unemployment goes up.
Yeah, I mean, so there's a tiny bit more to it than that, but let's go with that as the sort of divide. So it's a really interesting and richly kind of satisfyingly complicated picture. So I don't think the Tories managed the economy very well in their 13 years. However, the prevailing conditions were such that most people were much better off at the end than they had been at the beginning. And the Tories, of course, like governing parties always do, said, well, aren't we tremendous fellows? You know, what a brilliant testament to our genius. That obviously happened everywhere in Europe. So everywhere in Europe, at the end of after the Second World War, there's then a period of transition marked by great austerity and hardship in the late 1940s. And then for everybody in Western Europe, there is an explosion of enterprise, of confidence, of optimism in the mid-1950s. That happens in Britain too. You have full employment, as you do everywhere. Because you have full employment, that's part of the reason you have so much immigration, because there's a demand you need workers. And the Tories are able to sort of bask in the glow of that. So that Macmillan cartoon from 1959, where he's got the appliances, that's reflecting the fact that for ordinary people who are, you know, they don't read Philip Larkin poems, they don't follow the latest colonial shenanigans in kind of the Central African Federation or whatever. What they're interested in is the new washing machine, and they've just bought a new car. And their cousin has bought a new house. And so they reward the Tories, you know, in 1955 and 1959 with big election victories for that. But all the time there is this issue about prices, rising prices. And Britain is people conscious, I think, from the late 50s onwards, certainly from the early 60s onwards, that on quite a lot of indicators, when they're measuring things, they can see that Britain is doing things worse than its competitors. The British businesses are losing market share to Italian ones or German or French, Japanese, and that, you know, British capitalism is not firing on all cylinders, shall we say. So people are kind of conscious of that. And, you know, people are in the Tory party are becoming particularly anxious about inflation. Now, for someone like Harold Macmillan, who remembers really strongly the 1930s, he thinks, I don't care about inflation, because unemployment is the real sin. You know, he remembers the Great Depression. He remembers the dole queues. And he says, we cannot replace that. You know, we cannot repeat that. On the other hand, you have somebody who's a little bit younger, Enoch Powell. And Enoch Powell when he's kind of number two at the Treasury or whatever he is, he says, oh no, inflation is a great curse. Inflation is a cancer. And once it gets in, it will eat away at your economy. And we must make fighting that the priority. And if unemployment rises a little bit, who cares? You know, it's a shame, but it'd be better to deal with the inflation now. And the rift between them at the end of the 50s is a really interesting prefiguring, I would say, of the arguments that you have in the 70s and particularly the 80s under Margaret Thatcher. I mean, that's why that Macmillan on one side and his Chancellor, Peter Thornycroft and Enoch Powell on the other. That's why that, for sort of historians of conservatism, seems such a richly symbolic moment. Because on the one hand, you have the patrician, you know, sort of tweedy Macmillan, who's not that bothered about inflation and actually says, what's wrong, writes at one point, what's wrong with a little inflation, you know? Let the economy rip. Give people the money. Let them have fun. You know, we'll win the election, everyone will be happy and everyone will be in jobs. And on the other hand, somebody like Powell who says, no, harsh medicine. Give them the medicine now and they'll be better in the morning.
Yeah.
That obviously, it's such an interesting prefiguring of Thatcherism, of the arguments that would come with Thatcherism, because you could argue, particularly in Thatcherites, historians would argue, the longer you leave the problem, the worse it gets. And they look kind of, by the 80s, they were looking back to the row between Macmillan and his Treasury ministers and were saying, look, if actually Macmillan had dealt with the issue then, if he had educated the country, then we might not have ended up. I mean, whether that's true or not, I'm not entirely sure, because the numbers are tiny, actually. They're having arguments about minuscule amounts of spending and actually pretty not massive amounts of inflation. But I think it's the principle that comes to really matter. And it expresses something, you know, that will become a big divide in the history of the Tory party.
To what extent do you think the concerns about inflation are expressive of a desire to something that you might think is a template of the Tory party is minimum spending, public spending?
Yeah.
To what extent do you think their concerns about inflation are mediated through that? Because Macmillan, obviously, he could have been a Labour prime minister for all intents and purposes. He seems very keen to spend on a whole host of social institutions. To what extent do you think Powell and Thornycroft are coming from that side?
So I think Powell and Thornycroft are, they're probably representatives of certainly Powell, of a Tory tradition that is much more sceptical of... It's interesting because both sides claim that they are the true Tory tradition. If you're a Thatcherite, right, you would say the period after the Second World War, the Tory party falls into the hands of a load of people who are basically Whigs. They're not really conservatives. Harold Macmillan, as you said, you know, he's a Keynesian. He could have been a Labour politician. He could have moved but changed parties between the wars. Didn't, becomes Tory prime minister. But at heart, he's not, the gulf between him and, say, Margaret Thatcher later on is pretty large. On the other hand, people in Macmillan's tendency would say, well, somebody like Powell is not really a conservative. He's not really a Tory. He's a liberal. He's a 19th century liberal who just believes in a small state and laissez-faire. That tension is there at the heart of, you know, again, it's like the thing about is Britain going to be drawn to the United States or to Europe? That tension is unresolvable, because it's at the heart of the kind of conservative coalition. But I do think generally in the Conservative Party and in this period when they are the top dogs, there was a sort of sense, look, you know, we have to accept the Attlee era reforms. We're not going to reverse them. We're not going to be scrapping the NHS. We're not going to be rolling back the welfare state. We're not going to hammer the unions. We'll work with the unions, because this is what the public now wants. This is the new dispensation. And what we will do is we will administer it more efficiently than Labour would. And, you know, we'll have more room for enterprise and we'll lack some controls and we'll try to eliminate red tape when we see it. And of course, there are loads of people in the Tory party all through this period, grassroots Tories, who are a bit uncomfortable because they just think we should be doing more to, you know, turn back the clock a bit to a more laissez-faire state. state has got too big and all this kind of thing. But the people at the top of the Tory party, I mean, I'm massively, massively caricaturing them, but the slightly tweedy One Nation patrician people who are basically running the show, they don't really want to do that. I mean, many of them are shaped by the 30s, the Dolkews of the 30s, and they don't want to repeat them. But they also, they're shaped by the two world wars, by the kind of paternalistic sense that somebody like Macmillan has. You know, we were all in it together in the trenches. You know, I'm not going to throw my gamekeeper out on the Dolkew. You know, that kind of attitude. And that prevails, I think, in the Tory party all the way through this period. And then a bit more for the, let's say, the next 10 years or so. And then, of course, Margaret Thatcher comes in and everything changes.
Right. Okay. That's fantastic. So just to really wrap things up, I think listeners will get an impression of just how broad your approach has been in this book. You talk about so many facets of society. And that obviously, as you mentioned earlier, creates this very rich account where you really get an idea of what it's like to be, you know, an individual. Where did this approach come from? What was it that you thought was lacking in the way people thought about the 60s that you thought we needed to know about the movement and politics and the decline of empire all together in one book?
Oh, that's a brilliant question. So I can remember saying to somebody when I was pitching the book or something, I said, there are many books about Paul McCartney. There are many books about Harold Wilson. And there are many books about England winning the 1966 World Cup. But I've never seen one that had all three. And I had, first of all, as I think I mentioned earlier, because I was an Americanist, I studied, you know, I'd just finished my PhD in American history. And there are a whole load of books, particularly on 60s America that and 50s America that attempted to be kind of total histories to give you a sense of, you know, to have music, to have society, to have feminism, you know, all that stuff, as well as Vietnam and Kennedy and Johnson and Nixon. So I thought that would be doable for Britain. I mean, the British story is a bit more humdrum. There's no kind of Vietnam, there's no JFK, but it would be doable. The other thing that I thought was, I mean, there were other books in other periods. So, I mean, it's a completely different book on a different period. But there was a book I was reading at the time that I started thinking of this. I mean, it's so wildly different. It seems laughable. It was called From Alexander to Actium. And it was a history of the Hellenistic Age by a guy called Peter Green. So it's a portrait of 300 years after the death of Alexander the Great. Seems mad that this was an inspiration for 50s Britain. But anyway, but this book, it's like 7,000 pages long. And he just thought, and he must have clearly said to his editor at some point, you know, that bit about picking and choosing what I'm going to do. I'm just going to do all of it. I'm going to do everything. Ruins, coins, high politics, religion. I'm going to write about thousands of words about everything. And I was quite ambitious with the sort of arrogance of youth. I thought, I'll write about everything. I'll put it all in. It'll be a total history. But then the other thing that was really the guiding principle was, I thought, there are books on 60s Britain, and they're always books from the point of view of a very small group. I mean, actually, funnily enough, all the books I was thinking of at the time, they're all out of print now, so no one would know what they were if I mentioned them. But there were a few books on the 60s. You know, when you went to Waterstones to look for a book, you'll be kind of All Dressed Up by Jonathan Green or whatever. And they'd be books by people who were in the kind of the underground in the 60s, the bohemian world. So there'd be a lot of stuff about poetry readings, about taking drugs, about sort of sexual liberation and stuff. But what struck me as somebody born in 1974 was that there was no room for, you know, my parents in those books, or for my friends' parents, or for my parents' friends. You know, for the great mass of people that I kind of knew were out there. I mean, it's not to say that I thought that my parents were representative of the whole country, but I just thought, come on, there are an awful lot of people who weren't in London, who weren't in, but who didn't go to, most people, the vast majority of people didn't go to university. They don't appear in these books at all. And if they do appear, they appear merely as kind of racist Philistines who don't understand the exciting new beat poetry or whatever. And I thought, what I want to do is to capture what it must have been like to grow up in those years, to be the first people to watch television, to hear the Beatles, to do all these kinds of things, and to live in a country that's going through an enormous change in its kind of world position. And so that meant looking beyond kind of Westminster and stuff to, you know, what's the coolest thing, but what's the most popular thing? What's the things that people talk about when they meet in the corner shop, you know, when they go to the match on a Saturday, the football match? What are they chatting about as they walk to the ground? And to try and get into their heads a little bit. And I don't, funny enough, it never had it so good. I don't think actually I captured that quite as well as I did in the subsequent books in the series, because I was sort of finding my way really. And also, frankly, because as sources became more and more digitized, it became easier to do. But with that book, what I was doing was sort of starting a kind of journey. And I think I sort of got better and better at it.
The last book you published was up to 1981, 1982?
82. So it ends with the Falklands War. Yeah, right. Ends with the
war. How far are you planning to go?
So my expectation has always been that I would go to 1990. So when I first wrote Never Had It So Good, my expectation was that I would get to 1990 before 2010. So that tells you how slow and how kind of, I'm not sure whether I necessarily say lazy, but how disorganized I've been in that, the fact that I'm still only in 1982. But I think 1990 makes a nice cutoff point, because at that point, you know, you've got the end of Margaret Thatcher, the end of the Cold War. It just feels like a nice punctuation point in the story of modern Britain.
Great. Okay, fantastic. Well, looking forward to all of that.
Wonderful.
Dominic, thank you once again for this. It's been great.
Thank you. Thank you for your brilliant questions. It's been absolutely really, really good fun.
Thank you.